You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, a new bill would help pay off student loans for lawyers who take public defender appointments in the state's rural counties. We'll talk with one of the bill's sponsors about the details. Now, Americans gave more than $350 billion to charity last year, and one of the biggest times to give is during the holiday season. While people are opening their hearts and wallets to do a kindness, sometimes they get taken advantage of. On this Giving Tuesday, our next guest tells us how we can give safely and thoughtfully this holiday season. Jim Temmer is the CEO of the Better Business Bureau Wisconsin. Jim, welcome back to Central Time.
Hey, Rob, my pleasure. Always great to talk to you and your audience.
Well, Giving Tuesday and the holiday giving season, by and large, a positive thing. A lot of people being very generous. But let's look at the negative side. How common are apparently charitable scams around the holiday season?
Unfortunately, they're very charitable. You know, the charitable giving, our hearts open up this time of year. We're looking to help people out, and the scammers know that. And what they do is they take advantage of people. And almost every scam really relies on those scammers touching an emotional chord. And again, this time of year, people looking to make charitable donations, they have scams, they have fake websites. There's a lot of ways they do it, but it all relates back to having communication with you as an individual. So number one tip, if you're getting pressured, if that's on the phone, if it's in an email, if it's a knock on the door, stop communicating with them. Hang up the phone, delete the email. You know, you can shut or not answer your door. Don't feel pressured into making a contribution that you may not want to make. And if you do want to make it, take some time and go visit the website or call them back. A legitimate charity will want your money tomorrow or next week as much as they do today.
Yeah, what are some of those quick gut check indications that something might not be on the up and up?
Well, a few things. First of all, make sure if you're looking at websites that you're donating or you're searching the correct organization. Scammers come up with names that are very similar to good charities. For example, there's, you know, a long-standing great charity called the American Cancer Society. Well, a few years ago, somebody came up with a group and a website called the Cancer Fund of America. And they aren't around anymore. They were engaged in deceptive fundraising, and they aren't functioning. But that happens often. If it's for a well-known charity, make sure that the spelling is right, the website is correct, and the name is right, because it's very simple for scammers to throw something out there, and in the hustle and bustle of the holiday season, you may think you're doing good, but you're actually giving your money away.
How about that email we might get with a link? I mean, what I try to do, maybe this is smart, maybe not. Like, if I think it might be legit, might be something I'm interested in, I'll search online for the name of the group rather than clicking on that link to make sure I'm going to the right place.
Oh, that's right. And the phishing scams are big this time of year, too. They're looking for your personal information. If it's anything unsolicited, like I started with, even an email, you shouldn't be clicking links. You know, if there's the old trick, too. You can hover your cursor over the link, and it will show you the actual address that you're going to go to. So even if the text says it's going to, you know, the XYZ fund, you put that over there, and it'll show you, but it might be going somewhere else completely. So, right, go enter the web address yourself. Don't click on the links. And just be leery of anything that's coming in your email or even social media. You know, people also look to make charitable donations for the tax benefits of it. And one thing to keep in mind is things you see on Facebook or GoFundMe pages for individuals. They may need your money, but if you donate that way, that is not tax deductible. You know, it's got to be a certified 501c3 charity by the Internal Revenue Service, and you can always ask a charity if they have that 501c3 designation, and you can ask them for a copy of the designation letter from the IRS.
What's at risk if we get scammed? Is it just, oh, the 20 or however many bucks I gave away went to not a good cause, or can it be worse than that?
Well, if you use your credit card, of course, it can be worse than that, or it can be just your personal information. But credit cards, the one good thing about them is if you use them and you are scammed, you have a limit to your liability. Usually it's around $50. But the bad news is if someone gets your credit card information, they can go out there and try and use it. When entering your personal information, your name, address, birth date, or a credit card, two things. First of all, you want to make sure in the address line of the website, it's got an S at the end. So it's HTTPS, semicolon, whatever it is, and that S stands for secure. And there's usually a green padlock kind of logo along with that. The other thing you're going to want to do, as boring as it sounds, is check out the protection policy, the personal information policy on a website. They're going to tell you what they're going to do. Are they going to sell your information to somebody else? Are they not going to do that? Every website should have a policy listed like that on there for your personal information.
Talking to Jim Temer with the Better Business Bureau Wisconsin, looking at charitable scams, fake charities, that sort of thing, how to avoid them on Giving Tuesday and in this giving season. And Jim, we're saying a lot of negative stuff here, but I'm guessing you're not wanting to discourage people from giving.
Not at all. Give as much as you can. There are so many worthwhile charities, so many worthwhile causes. The people here in Wisconsin are great at supporting people in need, and there is need all over. We don't have to look very far to get that. But what we encourage people to do is you can give with your heart, but you've got to think with your head, because the last thing you want to do is have your money not end up where it's most needed. And the other thing, another thing I should say that you can do is you can check up even legitimate charities and see how much of those funds do go to the actual program itself instead of fundraising expense. You can go to give.org, give.org. That's the BBB's charity arm, and you can get reports on charities there. There's organizations like Charity Navigator or GuideStar that can give you very valuable information. Even our own Wisconsin Department of Financial Institutions, the WDFI, has reports on charitable organizations where you can find about their spending levels and other things. So make wise, informed decisions.
And how about, it might be a good idea, it sounds like, instead of waiting for them to come to us with that call or email or social media post, we can take the initiative and try to find groups we want to give to.
Right. We're very big into that. You should be instigating this search. If anything's coming to you, you have to think twice about it. And again, sometimes the telephone solicitors, the telemarketers, they may be working for a legitimate charity, but the costs of telemarketing are huge. So they will be keeping the majority of your donation, and a minority of it will be going to the charity of your choice. So even if you're on the phone with somebody who informs you of a great charity, we still would recommend you don't give them over the phone, but you find that charity's information online and you can give directly. Also, if someone's talking to you on the phone, you should always be able to request that they send you information, again, if it's their 501c3 designation or anything about their programs, and if someone refuses or says they don't want to, that's an immediate red flag.
I understand you are interested in getting kids involved in the giving process. How can we do that?
That's right. You know, we find that definitely when parents are involved with their children in philanthropy, you're going to create possibly a lifelong giver. The very first thing you do is talk to your kids about it. It's significantly more children grow up to be donors if their parents talk to them about it and show and tell them about it. Be upfront with it. Show your kids that you're doing something charitable and then tell them why you did it. The other thing we like to tell people is be a guide and not a boss. You know, let your child discover the causes they care about and nurture their passion. The other thing is, you know, you can tell them you don't have to be millionaires to make a difference. You can offer not only your money, but also your time, your skills, anything that you can to volunteer, and you let your child see there's more to giving than just dollars and cents. But study after study shows the earlier that you can involve kids in philanthropy, the more they're going to get out of it, and the more they're going to be giving back to their society.
Something else on our mind, getting back to potential scams. It's a big shopping season from Black Friday and Cyber Monday through post-holiday deal hunting. How can we watch out for retail scams in person or online?
Well, in person, a few things. You just got to keep yourself safe. Make sure that credit card that's coming in and out of your wallet or your purse, you know, 10, 15 times in a day is safe and secure. This is a huge season for pickpockets. You know, if you've got 3 shopping bags and your purse slung over your shoulder, it can be maybe easier for you to have that taken from you. When you're walking out to your car and it's nighttime, and again, you've got 5, 6 packages, just make sure you know your surroundings so you stay safe. If you're going store to store, put those packages with your valuables in them in the trunk so people can't see in the window. You do want to keep that credit card safe, but make yourself aware of what's going on. Instead of waiting for your statement to come at the end of the month, go online, check every week so you can see if there are some charges being made on your card that you didn't authorize or that you didn't make. You know, when you're shopping online, you have to be careful that it's a legitimate site. There are a lot of fake sites for merchandise. if it sounds too good to be true, we always say this, but it is. You know, you're not going to get that that specialty item that you find for $500 everywhere else for $100. It's probably a scam. Same thing as I said earlier about the secure socket, the S at the end of the HTTP when you're shopping online. You also want to compare, of course, compare prices, but compare apples to apples. You know, every 27-inch TV isn't the same. So make sure you get model numbers written down when you're shopping so you're actually comparing the same items to each other. Our number one hint, or for anybody this time of year, this has to do with purchasing items or making donations, is make a budget, stick to the budget. You don't want to get yourself in a situation where come January or February you're scrambling around because you spent too much money. It's so easy to do. We have, I mean, myself, people in our office, we've all done this in the past. It's so easy to overspend. So to any consumer that's out there, you know, make a budget and stick to that budget.
Jim, thanks a lot for joining us today. I appreciate it.
You bet. My pleasure. Happy holidays.
Jim Temer is the CEO of the Better Business Bureau Wisconsin. He joined us today to talk about charitable giving and how we can avoid scams during the holiday season. First, many young lawyers in Wisconsin are drawn to higher-paying jobs in Milwaukee or Madison, in part to pay off their student loans as quickly as possible. That's led to a shortage of lawyers in the state's rural counties, especially for low-income people who rely on public defenders for representation. A new bill aims to address that shortage by helping pay off student loans for lawyers who take public defender appointments in these rural counties. Representative Ron Tussler is a Republican from the state's 3rd Assembly District. That includes parts of Calumet and Outagamie counties. He's a co-sponsor of the bill, and he's with us in the studio. Representative Tussler, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Well, tell us more about the scope of this problem. What are we seeing out there?
Sure, absolutely. Well, you know, in our rural areas. So these are areas of a population, a county of less than 25,000. Some of these counties only have 3, 5, 7 attorneys in the entire county. But we have to provide a public defender for anybody that's charged with any crime that they could be held in jail or prison for a significant amount of time based on a case called Gideon v. Wainwright. So as a result of that, we have to do this. And what we've been doing as a state, and I think this is a mistake, is we've been paying a significant amount of money to have attorneys from Madison and Milwaukee drive all the way up to Ashland County or all the way up to Marquette County or some of these very distant counties. And that's expensive on our state. For example, in Ashland County, just last year, we only got less than 25,000 people in Ashland County, and we still spend $41,700 just on gas to drive people back and forth to make these appearances and for their time driving. So I think it's a real important, it's an opportunity that we have to spend our money more wisely. I would rather see this money go to helping kids that are struggling with student loans like I did when I graduated from Marquette Law School than for us to spend it on gasoline.
If I'm a defendant in this rural county, low income, say I need that public defender, is it difficult to find somebody? Does it take a while just to get access to an attorney to talk about my case?
Absolutely, and it's difficult on that individual because they're not going to have a ton of options either. We want to create more options. We want people to get good representation. See, you know, in the United States, we really believe in the adversarial system when it comes to legal process. So you have a district attorney's job who their job is to do their very best to prosecute the case, to show their side of the story of why this person committed a crime. And if they don't have a good public defender to defend them and show their side of the story, the judge, who's really supposed to be a officiant, who's really supposed to look at both sides and make a decision, or a jury make a decision, obviously, in a lot of cases in the criminal system, they can't do that if you only hear one side of the story.
So that brings us to your legislation now. Spell out how it would work.
Absolutely. Well, so right now it's a pilot program. This is a program that's already been successful in Nebraska, and we hopefully will bring it to Wisconsin. And what it will do is it'll set aside $250,000 a year for the first 2 years. So it's a pilot program. We're trying to see if we think this works. And what we're trying to accomplish is get individuals that are students that are getting done with school to move maybe back to rural Wisconsin where they're from, or to move to an area that they really love that's beautiful and represent individuals there. So the idea is to encourage people to kind of incentivize an opportunity for them outside of Milwaukee and Madison. You know, 60% of our attorneys in Wisconsin are in those two areas, Milwaukee and Madison. So all the other attorneys we have in this state are dispersed.
If I'm that attorney, that new graduate from law school, how much money could be taken off my student loans under this program?
Up to $20,000 per year, which is very significant. Now, you have to be focused to get, and it's going to have to do with the amount of applicants that are asking for it. So you're not guaranteed $20,000 if you meet the requirements, but up to $20,000 is a maximum anybody could get. That'd be a pretty significant cut into your loans if you did it. But you only can apply if you're taking 50 public defender cases, which is quite a few cases. You know, the average attorney might hold 60 to 70 cases total at one time. So you're mostly a public defender.
If I'm going up to do this, I mean, is there enough demand? Am I going to have enough work to keep me busy as an attorney in this smaller, in this rural county? I'll have, as you say, that public defender work. Is there enough else to keep me going?
Well, yes, I think absolutely. And the reason is that there's such a need right now. And adding one or two attorneys, you know, this is probably not a program that's ever going to need to have a, you know, a $10 million investment to make it work. But if we can just increase the number of attorneys up there, even, you know, a 20 attorneys or 25 attorneys up there, that would make a huge difference for the state as a whole.
Talking to Representative Ron Tussler. He's a Republican from the state's 3rd Assembly District, looking at the problem of making sure there are enough lawyers in rural counties, especially to represent people who need a public defender in their court cases. That's been a longstanding concern raised in large part by defense attorneys that public defenders don't get paid a lot, especially compared to other states. Do you think that's part of the problem in getting public defenders in these rural counties and elsewhere?
Absolutely. Well, when I was giving you the statistics of the number of attorneys are in these counties, that's in total. That's not just ones that take public defender cases. This is just the total. You know, for example, in Calumet County, where I'm from, there's 17 attorneys in that particular county. In Florence County, there's only 4 attorneys. So you don't even know that those 4 attorneys out in Florence County even take public defender cases. So there's a real significant need to get individuals to take it. And it's only $40 an hour is what you get, which $40 an hour would sound great if you didn't have expenses. But the truth is that when you include staff and a business, it's very hard for an attorney to come out at least ahead when they take public defender cases at $40 unless they have, you know, very little overhead.
I know it's not part of this legislation, but do you think that's part of the answer to increase that pay? Does the state need to raise what public defenders get paid?
I do. I think it's important that we do increase the amount, and I think that there's ways that we could do that that would incentivize, again, people to go to where we need them the most. For example, in a small misdemeanor case, it's easier to find somebody that'll take an appointment than a felony case or significant felony. Right now, if you were a public defender representing somebody in a felony murder case, you get $40. If you're representing somebody in a criminal damage to property, which is kind of the other end of the spectrum, you know, that would be a $40 case. So people take the easier cases, unfortunately.
Now, you mentioned you're an attorney yourself. I understand in your early years you did work as a public defender. I mean, is that experience part of what's making you interested in solving this problem?
Sure. You know, I started out and I would take the cases that I could take. And, you know, when you're starting your own business, you want to be busy and you want to have some income coming in. And so at one point I was taking in the public defender appointment cases to bring some income in and keep myself busy. But, you know, for kind of obvious reasons, I mean, we grew out of that. We had the ability to make more money in other cases. So we stopped taking those cases about maybe 3-4 years ago now. And it's unfortunately, that's business. And you can't expect people outside in the real world that are trying to, you know, pay their bills and do their very best in life to take a case that isn't as valuable as another case if all things are even.
For this student loan debt repayment thing, is this something that's under this bill that would just be for graduates of Wisconsin's law schools, or would you take people from out of state too?
Well, we want the people from out of state just as much as the ones from Wisconsin. I certainly think we got two great law schools, so I certainly would encourage anybody to go to either UW or Marquette University Law School. But if you go to another state, we need people up there. We need people that can represent these folks. So it's not really focused toward one over another.
And what's been the reaction from your colleagues in the legislature?
You know, from what I've heard so far, they definitely see that there's a need. There's always some financial pushback. You know, we're spending taxpayer dollars, and we always need to make sure that we're using them as wisely as possible. One thing I've learned, this is my first year in the legislature, one of the first things I've learned is that there's no shortage of worthy causes, but there is quite a significant shortage of taxpayer funds. So it's always difficult to try to prove to folks that my bill is the one we should spend this money on and not their bill. But I'm confident in this bill. I think it's a great idea, and I think especially the fact that economically we can show we're spending the money either way, we're better off spending it this way than spending it on gas and drive time.
And is there a timeline for this to go through committees and through the whole process?
Sure. Well, you know, we're going to be meeting again in January and February of next year. So once we get there as a session, I need to have my bill ready to be voted on by the assembly in general. So basically the next step is to go to the committee stage, and hopefully the committee will approve of the bill, and I can move it on.
Is this something you think you can see bipartisan support for?
Absolutely. Yeah, you know, there's a lot that we do in Madison that has bipartisan support. There's a lot we can do that. It's not really a political thing. It's just a good governance thing. And I think when we're spending money to reduce our student loans and encourage people to live in our rural areas as opposed to spending on gasoline and drive time, I don't think that should be a partisan issue. That should just be a good governance issue.
Representative Tussler, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you. Great to be here.
That's Ron Tussler, Republican representing the state's 3rd Assembly District, talking about his legislation that would offer student loan assistance for lawyers representing low-income people in rural counties. Republicans in the U.S. Senate are looking for the votes they need to pass a tax bill that they say will benefit the middle class and make the tax system more streamlined. The plan passed a big hurdle this afternoon when it was advanced by the Senate Budget Committee by a 12-11 vote. Republicans Bob Corker of Tennessee and Ron Johnson of Wisconsin had expressed reservations about the bill but ended up being yes votes. Stephen S. Smith is a professor of political science and the director of the Wiedenbaum Center on the Economy, Government, and Public Policy at Washington University. Stephen, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you. Great to be here.
Well, this is a story that's developing all day and all week. This was a big potential hurdle, this budget committee. Is that right?
Well, yeah, it's a committee that's comprised of 12 Republicans and 11 Democrats, so it could potentially turn the other way, and they needed to get the bill referred to the floor, and they got it.
And what do we know, as the bill stands now, about how tax cuts would be distributed for lower income earners, middle class, and so on?
Well, let me first say that there are several sources of estimates, and the source we care most about is something called the Joint Committee on Taxation, which is a staff on Capitol Hill that has economists and other tax experts, and Congress relies on them to provide an estimate. They announced, actually within the hour, that they will not have an estimate ready for the Senate tax bill until late tomorrow afternoon. The Senate plans to take up the bill on Thursday, so the Senate will have the benefit of the official estimate for only a short while before they go to the floor with the bill. It looks like the bill is going to have, in short, two or three effects. One, of course, is a sharp reduction in business or corporate tax rates from the upper 30s down to 20%, according to the Senate bill. The House bill is nearly identical in that respect. On the personal side, individual income taxes, there is a rearrangement of brackets so that most individuals will be in a bracket, one of seven different brackets. We currently have seven that will adjust downward most people's official tax rate. But at the same time, a number of tax breaks, including state and local income tax deductions, changes in how mortgage deductions are handled, and so on, will cause an increase in taxes. In order to make this affordable, the Senate sunsets, that is, brings to an end some of the changes in tax policy at various stages over the course of the next 10 years. And the best estimates that I've seen show that people in the lower income ranges will receive a small tax cut in the first few years, but that will disappear over the long run. Some will actually face a tax hike by the end of the 10-year period that these estimates are done for. The upper end, the multi-hundred-thousand-dollar end and up, will receive the largest tax breaks, and even at the end of 10 years, will still be experiencing a substantial tax break.
Talking to Stephen Smith from Washington University in St. Louis about the policy and politics of the tax overhaul now in the U.S. Senate. Stephen, Republicans can do this without any Democrats. They can lose a couple of Republicans. I want to move through some of the concerns from various Republicans, and one that's come up a lot, including Wisconsin's own Ron Johnson, it has to do with pass-through businesses. Can you tell us what that controversy is about and what could change there?
Well, many small and medium-sized businesses, of course, are privately owned, those owners generally pay taxes on their business profits at the individual income tax rate. Incorporated businesses are treated under a separate part of the tax code and have separate rates. The Republicans plan to bring the corporate tax code rate, tax rate down to 20%, but the individual tax rates will be at a much higher percentage for most middle and upper middle income business owners. And so Senator Johnson, Senator Dayne from Montana, and a few others have expressed a serious concern, especially Dayne and Johnson, that those small and medium business owners who have pass-through income, generally paid for at the individual income tax rate, should be getting a bigger break under this bill. And they've been holding out, at least until today, saying that they want to see a change on that side of things before they support the bill.
Is this like what happened in Kansas that people have been pointing toward, where that pass-through rate was lowered, a bunch of individuals basically turned themselves, in effect, into corporations to get that lower rate than they would pay as individuals?
That is a concern, because an awful lot of folks can incorporate and start selling their services as an incorporated entity and get a lower rate. The Senate bill includes some language, which I really can't detail for you here. I don't know it that well. That is intended to prevent that from happening. And there's some concern among senators that it's not strong enough and that stronger language needs to be put in the bill.
Another concern some Republicans have raised has to do with the health care individual mandate cut, which got rolled into the Senate plan, not at present in what passed in the House. Where is that now?
Well, it's still up in the air. There were some observers who thought that at least a couple of Republicans would object to that provision. Senator Collins especially has been concerned about health care. She's co-sponsored legislation to shore up Obamacare to stabilize the healthcare markets for those people who are on those exchanges. She seems to have backed off a little bit today. There's some a signal from her that she might allow the bill to go forward and hope that the problem will be addressed successfully in negotiations between the House and the Senate. She had actually hoped that her separate legislation would be passed first. There was some talk that she was going to make that a condition of supporting the tax bill, but she seems to have backed off from that today.
And then we have Republicans concerned about the impact these tax cuts would have on the deficit in the long run.
Yeah.
I know this. So there's a lot of arguments about the numbers here, but again, based on what we know right now, what kind of deficit impact could this have?
Well, the best estimate we have so far of the Senate bill is a $1.4 trillion addition to the national debt over a 10-year period. There's a little bit of disagreement about that, and that's why everyone's waiting for the Joint Committee on Taxation estimate. There's some discussion, of course. Republicans always insist on dynamic scoring because they think that if you cut taxes, you'll increase the flow of dollars in business, and that'll return revenue to the federal government, and so that the cost to the government won't be quite so great as you might think. Democrats point out that the deficit's bound to increase, and so the cost of supporting the deficit through interest payments will increase. And so the best estimates, honestly, are that the increase in the national debt will be in the neighborhood of $1.3-1.4 trillion over 10 years. It's really just a matter of a couple hundred billion either way over a 10-year period.
Now, Senator Bob Corker, as we mentioned, he voted for this in committee. He was one of the people worried about its impact on the deficit. I'm hearing a phrase I haven't heard before. I don't know exactly what it means. A revenue trigger being added to the Senate bill. What is that?
Well, we don't know yet because no language has been offered by anyone, as far as I know. But I'm sure that the general idea is that if federal revenues fall below a specified level, we don't know what that is yet, that it would trigger an increase in taxes to make sure that we meet that revenue target, thereby reducing the total deficit. But how that would work, whether it would work, is unclear.
I'm going to go out on a limb and say there are some Republicans who would object to the idea of a basically mandated tax increase in certain scenarios.
Yeah. I mean, the supply side argument that we need to cut taxes in order to spur the business investment and in turn increase jobs would be greatly undercut by the uncertainty that would occur year after year about whether or not a trigger is going to be pulled. If the whole point of this is to, settle tax policy for the long term, reduce taxes, and encourage people to make long-term investments, a trigger is probably the surest way to undermine that.
We're talking to Stephen Smith. He's a professor of political science and director of the Wiedenbaum Center on the Economy, Government, and Public Policy at Washington University. He's with us to talk about the ongoing political fight over the tax legislation being considered in the U.S. Senate. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think of what you're seeing on taxes in the Senate and the House? Are you on board with the changes that could potentially come if the tax legislation passes? Do you like the idea of tax cuts, corporate tax cuts, individual tax cuts? Are you worried about potential impacts on the deficit or on federal programs? Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're continuing our conversation about the political fight over tax overhaul legislation in the U.S. Senate. Stephen Smith is with us, professor of political science and director of the Wiedenbaum Center on the Economy, Government, and Public Policy at Washington University. And with you, if you call in at 800-642-1234, what questions do you have about the tax plan and the politics surrounding it? Call in at 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. Before we go to our caller, Stephen, I want to make this complicated story a little more complicated. There's another debt ceiling deal coming up here, potentially. Democrats supposed to meet with President Trump and Republican congressional leaders today. They opted out, Nancy Pelosi and Chuck Schumer, after President Trump tweeted, yeah, no deal's going to happen, basically. Here's President Trump now talking about that decision this afternoon.
So they decided not to show up. They've been all talk and they've been no action. And now it's even worse. Now it's not even talk.
So with this debt ceiling looming again, does that have any impact on this tax debate going on?
Well, not directly, but it certainly intensifies the sharpness of the partisan era atmosphere in Washington, and so it doesn't help. But, you know, here are the Democratic leaders put in a position of going to the White House after the president just hours earlier said that there's not going to be any compromise. There's going to be no deal making. You know, it's obvious to them that it's nothing but a photo op. And it puts, you know, those Democratic leaders in a very difficult spot. The president's leadership really is the issue here. The president's the one person who can bring both House and Senate, Democratic and Republican leaders together in one place. And frankly, today, I think he blew it.
Let's go to our callers now on taxes with Ben on the line in Madison. Ben, hi.
Good afternoon. A question for your guest. Is there any support for this tax plan among citizens? Like, is anyone advocating for it, or are there any significant numbers of people who have actually said that they want this?
Well, Ben, I think that the public support for this is tepid. A majority of Republicans seem to support the general idea of tax cuts, but even a majority of Republicans are unsupportive of some of the ideas, like sizable tax cuts for corporations and for the well-to-do. Democrats are pretty uniformly against most of the provisions of the Republican plans, and so all told, a majority of Americans oppose the Democratic bill. I've seen polls that show only a quarter or maybe a third of Americans have, you know, expressed general support for what the Republicans are proposing. So this is actually, I think, a pretty risky political move on the part of the Republicans. They're following through on commitments to cut business taxes and to cut the taxes of most Americans, at least in the very short run, but they're doing it in ways that I think set them up for some political trouble over the next few years.
Ben, thanks for that call. Go next to Stu on the line in Milwaukee. Stu, hi.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call. Some of my question was answered by the last person's question, but mine was with the taking away of the death tax, the wealthy's tax cut, and the corporate tax cuts being permanent, and the lower income and middle class being sunset, what is the Senate's impression of that action?
Well, I think it's politically dangerous. The Republicans, of course, argue that Congress will not possibly allow those individual income tax breaks and tax changes in tax rates actually disappear. But the Republicans are pursuing a strategy that kind of boxed them in procedurally. In order to avoid a filibuster in the Senate and allow a simple majority in the Senate to determine the outcome here on the tax bill, they needed to follow some budget rules. And those budget rules say that the deficit cannot be increased after 10 years by this bill. And so if you cut taxes in many, many locations, it's bound to cause sharp reductions in revenues and create some deficits out past that 10-year window. And so the easiest way to avoid that is to prevent some of these taxes from occurring, at least artificially say that these tax cuts will come to an end at some point between now and 10 years, and then just cross your fingers that Congress will actually change its mind, put those tax cuts back in place, and avoid the tax hikes that would otherwise automatically come. In the meantime, you just get economic estimates that the deficits aren't going to be as large as projected. I should add, Stu, that the Republicans have put in place a rule that says that the tax bill can increase the deficit $1.5 trillion within the 10-year window, but beyond that 10-year window, it can't increase the deficit at all, and that's put them in a terrible bind.
Stu, thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. We're talking to Stephen Smith from Washington University, looking at the latest on tax overhaul efforts currently in the U.S. Senate. Back to your calls now. Richard is with us in Viroqua. Richard, hi.
Hi. I don't know. Maybe you guys can correct me. Aren't we in seven wars currently? And, you know, as far as I know, no tax cut has ever created jobs. So I'm not really sure or understand, other than, you know, transferring wealth to the rich
anything other than that this tax cut does.
Well, I got you, Richard. Thanks for the call. And, Stephen, that's a core economic debate. Do tax cuts create jobs? Or maybe a different question, in what situations do tax cuts create jobs?
Well, you have that exactly right. Some kinds of tax cuts can make a bigger difference than other kinds. The general argument here is that a deep cut, basically a 50% cut in the corporate tax rate, will somehow generate jobs. The argument goes that if business has more money, it'll make more investment. Those investments will create more jobs. The counterargument, which the caller suggests, is that tax cuts certainly create savings for business, but business will put that money to other kinds of purposes. They'll pay off debt. They will increase CEO pay. They'll make new investments, but it'll be in machinery and automation and maybe actually cost jobs in some locations. The Democrats argue that that's generally the case, and what really makes a difference for jobs is more consumers, and that this particular bill doesn't do enough for middle-income Americans. More could be done to increase the size of their tax break so that they had more money to spend, and that might have a greater effect on jobs.
Thanks a lot for that call. And Stephen, let's look at the other side of things here. We've been talking about revenue and taxes. How about spending? There's been concern from critics of this tax plan that it'll basically force the federal government to cut spending, maybe in the so-called entitlement programs like Social Security and Medicaid.
Yeah, two things have been kind of confused. One is that the president himself has said that the next big issue for his administration will be welfare reform. And by that, I think he means, generally speaking, social welfare programs. The two biggest are Social Security and Medicare. I think that there's a very good chance that the Republican Congress will take him up on that, and that would be a major battle over the next year or maybe longer. The second issue sometimes is misread. It is true that when the Republicans put their budget resolution in place that authorized this tax bill, they put also a provision in there that provided for deep cuts in Social Security and Medicare. However, they didn't authorize any legislation to accomplish that, so it was a meaningless gesture. But it kind of indicated their sensibility about how to deal with long-term deficits. And surely, if our long-term deficits do increase by $1.5 trillion over 10 years and maybe more over the longer term, government spending will be the focus. Discretionary spending in domestic programs like education and the environment have already been cut to the bone quite a bit over the last 10 years. That leaves defense spending, and the Republicans want to increase that, and the major entitlement programs, Social Security and Medicare.
We'll leave it there for now. Stephen, thanks a lot for joining us today.
My pleasure.
That's Stephen Smith. He's a professor of political science and director of the Wiedenbaum Center on the Economy, Government, and Public Policy at Washington University. He joined us today to talk about the political fight over the tax overhaul legislation in Congress, passed a key Senate committee earlier today.